This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In 1998, Sierra Leone was in the midst of a brutal and tragic civil war. Among the victims, children. Many were maimed, others drugged, beaten, and forced to serve as child soldiers.
That year, in 1998, American families adopted 29 children from McKinney, a town in the northern part of Sierra Leone. Years later, after the war ended, the birth families came forward and claimed that the children were stolen, all of them.
Investigative journalist E.J. Graff pieced together the many confusing and conflicting parts of this story in a recent series in Slate, the online magazine. The story raises difficult questions about international adoption. How can American parents be sure of the history of their adopted children? The trustworthiness of the process, is it moral? And when thousands of dollars in agency fees and millions of dollars in humanitarian aid are involved, how can anyone be sure that children are not being bought and sold?
So in today's talkers, we're especially interested in hearing from families who have adopted internationally. What was the process like? Did you ever have any concerns? And a question for everybody out there, how can we be sure the international adoption process is as transparent and ethical as possible with so much money and so many children changing hands? Give us a call today at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at radioboston.org. Well, joining us now is E.J. Graff. She's a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University. Her article series, The McKinney Children, appeared in Slate, and there's a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. E.J. Graff, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's a pleasure to be here.
True pleasure to have you. The story that you report is amazing, and it starts with a young boy whose name, once he arrived in the United States, was Samuel Mosley. Can you tell us a little bit about who Samuel is?
Samuel started life as Suleiman Suma. He was adopted by Judy and Tony Mosley when he was, I think it was 3 and a half, and became Samuel Mosley. His early years of life involved some kinds of deprivation, and we can't know exactly what kinds.
And the Mosley family is actually quite an interesting one.
Oh, they're a spectacular family.
Samuel wasn't the first child that they had adopted internationally.
Yeah, Judy and Tony Mosley are really started an extraordinary family. She's a white British woman, and he is an African American man. They met in Bahrain.
He was a naval officer.
He was
right?
A naval officer. She worked for Qantas Airlines, and now they are just leaving Guam. I think they're moving to Singapore. I can't remember. But they've spent most of their lives, their married lives, in the Pacific. They had had two children biologically, and a friend persuaded them in the 90s that the ethical thing to do for the universe, instead of having more biological children, was to adopt some of those who need families. And they just thought that was a great idea, as so many people do. They adopted their first child from Vietnam, Hannah, at 4 months old. And then when Judy got the quarterly magazine from their adoption agency, MAPS, she saw this little boy with haunting eyes on the back of the magazine and basically said to her husband, we have to save that boy.
And that little boy was Samuel.
That little boy was at that moment Suleiman Suma, living in a child welfare center in McKinney, Sierra Leone.
And Suleiman Samuel wasn't, they didn't end their adoptions there. I mean, really opened their hearts and their homes to, I believe, five international children total?
They couldn't stop. I asked her, Judy, did you start out intending to have such a big family? She said, well, no, there just always seemed to be need. Yeah, then she adopted one. I think the next one was from Cambodia. That was Cameron. And then she adopted two more children from Vietnam, one girl, and then that girl's sister who had some medical issues.
So when I'll call him Samuel because that's what his family here in the United States calls him, even though in Sierra Leone he is known as Suleiman. When Samuel first came to the United States, I mean, he had, it seems to be, many of the indications of a child that was living in war-torn privation.
Oh, he absolutely. He couldn't stop eating. She tells the story that he ate two whole chickens, including the bones. And when she tried to take one of the bones away from him, he bit her. He could eat, what did she tell me, a couple of dozen eggs a day. He just could not stop eating. He was clearly malnourished. He had red hair, which is a malnourishment indicator if you're African. And the big belly, and they had to put him through a lot of psychiatric and medical care to bring him home.
I was especially moved by how you wrote that that Judy Mosley told you that on the first night that he was with them, Samuel refused to take off his shoes and clothes and just wanted to keep them on his body when he slept at night.
You never know when you might have to run away.
Yeah. So, I mean, all the indications for them was that they had indeed saved a child from a brutal civil war that was going on in Sierra Leone. But, I mean, the Mosleys also present this other interesting sort of side to this tale because they found out later that there was some conflict over how Samuel arrived to them, but it wasn't the first time.
Absolutely not.
There were questions over a child that had come to them.
They tangled with fraud repeatedly, and Judy Mosley is very unusual in that. I've been reporting on fraud and corruption in international adoption for a couple of years. Judy is one of the few who will be very public about what her experiences have been. So she had. I first talked to Judy when I was reporting on the problems with the child who had been adopted from Cambodia.
One of her daughters adopted.
Yes. Her daughter, Cameron Mosley, who's now a professional model, spectacularly beautiful child, young woman, I should say now, young woman. And she, once Cameron learned to speak English, she started telling Judy about this family she still had back in Cambodia, in Siem Reap. And Judy investigated and realized that everything in the documents were about from that adoption were fraudulent. She was supposed to be six on the paperwork. It said she was six and had been living in the orphanage for years. In fact, she'd been living with her older sister. Her mother had only recently died. She'd been living with her sister's family. She was closer to 10 or 11, which was confirmed by doctor's reports. And she and Cameron ended up testifying in the sentencing hearing of the Lauren Galindo, who arranged more than 800 adoptions from Cambodia and apparently was involved in quite a structure of fraudulent adoption, solicitation, coercion, and baby buying.
Now,
the reason
why I wanted you to share this part of the story is because, again, to be clear, Cameron is one of the Mosley's other children.
Correct.
And was adopted from Cambodia. But her story could only have been told once she learned English. So that little girl, who's a young woman now, was living with this knowledge the whole time but couldn't actually communicate to her family that what you know about me is not true, which I want us to keep in mind because
it's very important.
Tells us about the complications and how difficult it is to find the truth in these situations. But regarding Samuel,
when I interviewed her about Cameron, I wrote that story up for the Washington Post. I mean, she had already told that story publicly several times, but I had it in a, it was part of a different story. When I talked to Judy, she said, you know, I don't have confidence in a lot of things, but there, of the children I've adopted, I have one I know I really saved from the Civil War and destitution, and that was Samuel. And that's when she first told me about him. And then she called me up a year ago and said, oh my God, I think he might have been stolen too.
Has happened again to their family.
Happened again.
So what was going on in McKinney, in the town where Samuel came from, that led to these 29 children even being made available for adoption?
That's quite the question. That's very contested. What is clear, there's a civil war. Horrible civil war we've all heard about Sierra Leone. An organization called HANSI, Help a Needy Child International, had approached MAPS, this Maine Adoption Placement Services, which is an international adoption agency based in Portland, Maine, and said, we have children who need adoption. We have a British sponsor who funds some of our projects, but we have some children who also need new homes. Will you fund an orphanage for them and find them families? Dawn Degenhart, who was the founder and executive director, went to Sierra Leone and was shocked by the conditions she found there, and came up with the humanitarian funds to help them care for some of these children. What she didn't know was that Hansi's operatives, John Blah, spelled G-B-L-A, John Blah and Henry Abu, had solicited those children from families in McKinney. They had gone door to door asking families to send their children to this child welfare center at 6 Mission Road.
Now, here's where it becomes unclear. Okay?
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And it's kind of a tangled web and difficult to keep all the pieces in mind. So there's MAPS, which is the main adoption and placement agency.
Yes, and as far as I can tell, fabulous motives, deep humanitarian desire.
And they are working in Sierra Leone, amongst
other
countries.
They are not in Sierra Leone.
But they have a
partnership with HANSI, yes, which is a local child welfare organization.
And it's that local, members of that local child welfare organization who went around the town of McKinney and said, what? We will give your children food? We will educate your children? What?
The question is, what did they say? HANSI says they told the families, we're going to... Americans are going to adopt your children, take them home, and they will have a better life. What the McKinney families now say, and what they've been saying for years, at least since 2004, is that all they were told is that if they would send their children to this child welfare center, their children would receive food, board, and an education up to university level. That's the phrase they all use, up to university level, which I understand is a college degree. Or anyway, that's what they told me.
Which is significant in a place like Sierra Leone where all education the family has to pay for.
Yes,
many
they
can't
could
afford
not afford
it.
No, they could not afford the school fees. So the ones I spoke with told me pretty universally that it was a difficult decision. They did not want to have somebody else raise their children, but they decided they wanted the education for at least one child. So they're all 3- and 4-year-olds, maybe not all, but they're all fairly young children who went to this center. And one day they went to visit, and they all said they went to visit. They all said they brought treats.
Oh, that the families went
families.
To visit.
The okay. parents went to visit regularly. The one man I spoke with, Abubakar Kargbo, told me that he would go visit his little brother and sister regularly and play with them after his schooling. And then one day they come. The rebels have invaded McKinney. They go to number 6 Mission Road, and the children aren't there.
So
then for years, no one will tell them where the children are.
And no one would tell them until long after the war ended, the Civil War ended.
No one would tell them where the children were. They got different answers. Oh, they've gone to America for an education. Oh, they've gone to Ghana for medical treatment. Oh, they've gone to Freetown because they'll be safer there. They get different answers as the years go by, but they never really know where their children are.
Well, we're talking about the story of the McKinney children. American families who believed they were adopting 29 orphans from Sierra Leone in 1998, but later on find that the birth families claim those children were stolen. And the questions that this story raises about international adoptions, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. E.J. Graff is my guest. She is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis, and her article, The McKinney Children, appeared recently in Slate. There's a couple callers I want to get to in just a moment, but before I do, E.J. Graff, I guess the question is, there's a counterclaim to all this. This
Correct.
Is yet another layer on top of this complicated story, and that is that some people in Sierra Leone are claiming that the birth families, if I understand correctly, mm-hmm. are coming forward now because they want money.
That's what the HANSI people say. They, to an individual, the ones that I spoke with, said that this is all because they want money. They know they always knew their children were going to America. They always knew their children were going to be adopted, but they thought that eventually they would get money out of the deal, and now that's what they want.
This is just one story,
right.
So we have to acknowledge that. But on the other hand, I mean, the details that you reveal, I imagine that they're not unique to a place like Sierra Leone. How common is it that international adoptions are contested?
Well, that's the $64 billion question, really, isn't it? There's no way to know. I mean, as you noted, the extraordinary thing about Judy Mosley's discovery that Cameron had been solicited from a family that she already had. It was possible for her to know that because Cameron was older. Mm-hmm. But babies who can't speak can't tell you later, you know, in fact, I did have a family and my mother never meant to give me up. There are a number of countries that have had fraud indicators that the State Department has put forward or that local newspapers have chronicled in great detail. When I say local, I mean the national newspaper of the country, like La Prensa in Guatemala, mm-hmm. or the Phnom Penh Post in Cambodia. There have been a lot of in-depth investigations done in countries. But we, people who are adopting in the United States or in throughout Europe, because they're also big adopters, don't necessarily hear about that. So when numbers of adoptions are going up rapidly in a country, that's from a country, that's a sign that something fishy might be going on. When people are trying to, when there are a lot of healthy babies coming out of a country very rapidly, that's a big sign to beware of what's happening in that country, because worldwide, there are really not a lot of healthy infants in need of new families. The children in need of new families worldwide are mostly, have for the most part, the profile of children in American foster care. They're five or older. Mm-hmm. They've seen some kind of trauma. They're medically disabled, or there's some other issue that their families are going to have to deal with.
Well, we have a number of callers who want to join us, so let me welcome them into the conversation. And also, just as some context here, the State Department says that in 2009, almost 13,000 children from around the world were adopted into families in the United States. Most of them were from China, Ethiopia, South Korea, and Russia, that I can tell, and 360 adoptions to Massachusetts families in particular. Let's hear from one of them. Gail is calling from Malden. You're on the air, Gail.
Hi, thank you very much. I guess my question is, we also adopted from Cambodia and through Lauren Galindo, but our agency was MAPS, and they had a second-party agreement. So I was interested to hear that MAPS also was involved in the most recent scandal. And I guess I would wanted to talk or hear them. You talk about the responsibility that these legal and upfront organizations have toward their partners, since they were involved in both scandals.
Gail, can I ask you a question first?
Yes.
What is your sense of that adoption from Cambodia? Are you confident that it was kosher?
Well, we have since done some investigating and found out that most likely it probably was okay. I can recall that when we got to Cambodia, you know, our work had been done through MAPS. And when we met Lauren, immediately I was like, you know, something's not quite right here. Just the way that the whole way it was just didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. So I had a sense that as a whole, that was not a healthy process. Whether or not our individual experience was appropriate,
yes,
or not, I think we tend to believe, we'll never really know,
yes,
but our evidence is that it probably was an up above the board adoption.
Gail, hang in there with us. I want to get E.J. Graff's answer to your question about the legal obligations, but also to remind listeners, Lauren Galindo, as you mentioned, E.J. went to jail. Is that correct?
She went to jail. She pled guilty I think it was visa fraud and tax financial structuring. It was Al Capone kind of charges, because there is no U.S. law that says it's not against the law to buy a baby for the purposes of adoption. So she could
buy a baby from abroad.
From abroad. Correct. Correct.
It is not against the law in the United States.
It is not against U.S. law. Yes. So there was no way to convict her for that.
So regarding Gail's question about the legal obligation that a adoption agency like the Maine Adoption and Placement Services, MAPS, has, what is the current state of agencies' legal obligations then?
I'm not going to be able to give a straight answer. The regulations are very complicated. It's really not clear. Certainly at the times that we're talking about, 1998, and when you adopted from Cambodia, Gail, there was no federal structure in place that regulated international adoption whatsoever. That was entirely a state matter. MAPS was governed only by Maine state law. And, of course, the ability of Maine child welfare investigators to check up on how things were going overseas would be pretty limited. But the U.S. government had no power there. So there was then no legal responsibility to check. Ethical, obviously, I think we might feel differently. Now there's a regulatory structure in place, but it's still not clear what, for a country that is not a party to the Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption, as Sierra Leone is not, as I think Cambodia is trying to be, but it hasn't been approved. Mm-hmm. It's not clear that there is any legal sanction for being involved with a troubling partner overseas.
E.J. Graff, there's a point that you make in your stories that I want to really sort of settle on, or not settle on, but touch on before we run out of too much time here. And that is that so much of this process relies on, as you said, just sort of an ethical gut check.
Yes.
It relies on trust. It relies on a lot of sort of independent investigation that would-be parents and agencies have to do, et cetera. All those things are difficult enough as it is, but they get even more difficult when we're talking about, as you say, the vast sums of money that
Absolutely.
Are involved here, not just Absolutely. In the fees that parents have to pay to agencies, but there's a lot of humanitarian aid coursing throughout the system here.
Yep.
And that many of these potentially fraudulent adoption agencies in the foreign countries are set up just to skim money from this humanitarian aid. I mean, you go so far as to write as there's too much Western money in search of children.
Absolutely. That's the problem. You can have high-minded American adoption agencies, good-hearted people who truly want to do good things for children. And if they're sending $10,000 to support an orphanage, that's a year's per child. That's a year's income for somebody in Sierra Leone or Vietnam or Guatemala or Cambodia. That's an enormous amount of money. That's money that could be divided up to pay off governmental figures for fraudulent documents. And there's no way to trace it.
So does that mean that there's no way to use that money to try and enforce some sense of trust and ethical behavior?
I will say I would not advise anyone to adopt from a country that is high on the fraud and corruption index that is put out by somebody somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Someone will
know. I was looking at the State Department's international adoption website. They have
yep.
a pretty big warning right there on their front page about potential countries that might be at issue.
Well, by the time it gets to the State Department's website, they're really bad. Anytime the State Department has to have an enormous amount of evidence before it can put
okay.
anything up at all. Remember, they have conflicting responsibilities. They want to have good diplomatic relations with the country. So they're not necessarily going to say nasty things about their adoption process if they can't really prove it.
Well, we're fast running out of time here. It feels like
sure.
we've only skimmed the surface on such a sure. complicated but important issue. But let me just ask you very, very briefly, what happened to Samuel?
He's still with the Mosleys. He's happy, healthy, beautiful young man.
And is there any chance that his family in Sierra Leone might get to see him?
I haven't talked to Judy, but I think she would like that.
Okay. Well, E.J. Graff, senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University and author of The McKenney Children, an article appeared in Slate. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There's a link to E.J. Graff's article, by the way, on our website, radioboston.org. We'll be back after a short break, and we'll hear from Tina Packer, a Shakespeare scholar who takes on a Texas legend, Molly Ivins. And we'll go out on a little classic palm wine music from a Sierra Leonean singer, S.E. Rogie. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Oh, yes, I'm Radio Boston.